you commented briefly on the fact that translations are interpretation dependent. Do you think we need a new translation of the Old Testament?
No. No, we have loads of them. No, we always need to improve our understanding. And there's always things that can stand revision and upgrading. But remember, the translation is not where you would expect to find cutting-edge understanding of interpretation of text. Translations have an inclination, and there's a good reason for it, an inclination to be more conservative. That is, to kind of stay in the main body of the way people think. The translation is not where cutting-edge work is done. Because if people find stuff in their translations that are uncomfortable to them because they're kind of cutting-edge and unfamiliar and non-traditional, they just won't buy the translation. And then the publisher loses a lot of money. So, no, I don't think a translation is the way to do it. Maybe eventually translations will show some revisions, but that's... Nobody. Yes? And then,
so God gave them the tree of life. What's the purpose of God putting that tree of life?
Okay. God gave them the tree of life. What's the purpose for him doing it? Well, to offer them life. Again, they didn't have it. They were mortal. He offered the tree as an antidote, as a remedy. But remember, okay, this has nothing to do with whether it's a literal tree or not. Let's say it is. That's fine. I'm perfectly fine with that. Okay, but even then, it's not really the tree that gives life. It's God who gives life. God is the source of life, not a fruit. This is not antioxidants here. So the tree may well represent, again, as a physical, material object, it may well represent the life that comes from God. But don't mistake it, the life comes from God. The analogy I think of is Samson's hair. You know, is it Samson's hair that made him strong? Well, no, it's God's strength. But did his hair have something to do with it? Only because God made it that way. Okay, so same thing with the tree. Don't get hung up on the trees. What the trees offered, life and knowledge of good and evil, comes from God.
So why would God put that, the other tree, the tree of, knowledge?
Well, again, those are both things that come from God, and they're different things. Tree of wisdom, tree of life. Both wisdom and life are found in God, and therefore they're found in the middle of God's presence, because that's where God is. And those trees represent that. Again, whether they are actual physical trees and fruit that represent that, that's fine. But even if they're not, that's fine.
And then some people say that tree, if it's a literal tree, then it's a temptation for the two people there.
Well, really, though, the temptation is that they want to be do their own thing. They want to be like God. Okay. Yes?
Well, I think you just mentioned good and kind qualities, but I've lived off of the assumption that you're breaking down a lot of stuff in church temple. But I'm just having a hard time envisioning God working through processes. And you're saying, because we envision God as like perfect, so why would he need to use processes in order to get something started?
He doesn't need to use processes. And if he chooses to use processes, we can't second-guess him. You know, it's obvious that God has chosen to use processes. Again, it was a long time before Jesus came. It was a long time again for Jesus to come. And so God does work in processes. When he reveals himself, it's a process. He doesn't just, come to Abraham and pop the Ten Commandments on him and give him a doctrinal statement and here's a list of attributes, we're done. You know, it's a process of revealing himself. With Israel's history, it's a process. We're just observing. This is what God does.
Are you saying God uses processes in the way of communicating with mankind? That's only
maybe. Again, on those kinds of things, unless the Bible tells me, I don't know. Yes?
Let me make a part of like snapping rain on the earth and no trumpet appeared, but.
Both Genesis 1, Genesis 2, well, 2, 5, and 6, start with non-order. Genesis 1, it's Genesis 1, 2, and it starts with non-order relative to the functioning of the cosmos. In Genesis 2, it starts with non-order, and that's non-order with regard to the terrestrial situation of people. that those kinds of things necessary for people's existence are not yet taking place. Again, these were just talking, by the way, the words for shrub of the field and things like that, there are not just all green plants. They are particularly tilled, irrigated plants that are not there. Those people aren't there. Okay. Yes, sir?
Yeah, what does the wisdom really represent in the garden? Because doesn't God want Adam to have the wisdom to keep and serve?
Sure. Wisdom is something that certainly God wanted people to have. But wisdom is something that has to be earned and learned, not just dumped. Okay? And therefore, wisdom was something that you need a mentor for. You need instruction. Remember, a proverb in the mouth of a fool is like the legs on a lame man. They get you nowhere. Wisdom cannot be grabbed, snatched, or just acquired by absorption. Wisdom is something that is taught and learned. And I assume that God intended that process to take place. People wanted it their own way. Remember, Christ was given the same chance in the wilderness. Okay? All the kingdoms of the earth were supposed to belong to him. And Satan says, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the earth that belongs to you. You should have that. But no, there's supposed to be another process. That's not the way to get it. Okay? So, yes?
Would you comment on their eyes were opened after they ate the...
Comment on their eyes being opened. Well, up to then, their eyes were closed. No, okay. Again, with the eating of the fruit, the gaining of wisdom, the main thing that they gain is accountability. But on this one, I'm more with Irenaeus. Irenaeus talks about original innocence rather than original righteousness. Augustine talked about original righteousness. And again, really what he's getting at is that there wasn't sin. But Irenaeus, I think, fleshes it out a little more in terms of original innocence, that there was no accountability. And so the unawareness of their nakedness comes with that original innocence. It just wasn't an important thing. I mean, talk to any six-year-old, it's just not important now. Four-year-old, or whatever. Okay? And so it's that kind of idea. So they, with that wisdom, came accountability, came awareness, came all kinds of things, more than they counted on. Yes, sir?
Correctly. Are you saying that the earliest readers or hearers of this Genesis 1 and 2 account would have understood this as archetypal, and we've lost that over the years, and you're reclaiming a lost perspective? Or is this a new thing?
Well, that's exactly what I call it, lost world of Adam and Eve. Okay? We are trying to recover how they would have thought about it. Again, that's why I use the biblical evidence the way I do, to try to demonstrate that archetypal thinking is what's going on.
So do you have any idea when that archetypal understanding was lost?
Well, that's a long process. I mean, you must be saying that this is a long process. The same thing on the Genesis 1 material, right? You can start thinking materially instead of in terms of order and function. And the big answer, the quick, easy answer is Hellenism. Okay. Hellenism brought a way of thinking to the world from the Greek philosophers that just was probably that. It revolutionized the way we have thought since that time. Now, that's extremely simplistic. I know some of you are historians and church historians and philosophers, and you're cringing inside that I'm so reductionistic in how I worded it. But that's the general direction of it. Yes, you know, people always interpret the Bible to meet the needs of conversation with their culture and world. And so the conversation was the Enlightenment, the conversation is Bible and science. And you tend to try to tap into the text to have your current conversations. And as a result, we lose things.
Follow up a bit. What could happen, or what does happen, surely you've heard something, happen when you read the parallel, what parallels there are, not a lot, parallel accounts that are attempts to explain the sorts of things. In other words, to what extent should the in Mesopotamian mythology, Greek mythology, and Egyptian mythology. How should that be read?
Well, we should use that information as windows to how people thought in the ancient world. Israel sometimes thought a lot like people in the ancient world. Other times they just thought in the same categories. Other times they were very much opposed to it, but they still thought in the same frame of reference. In other words, they didn't leave the room and go to another room. They had a conversation in the room they were in. Therefore, it's very helpful for us to understand the ancient world, because then we can understand the issues that would have existed then. So it can be very helpful for us to understand the biblical text. It can be very helpful for us to understand the biblical text in light of the ancient world, but that doesn't mean we think that they would have the same theology or those kinds of issues. But they're going to share lots of the same kind of framework as the world. And that's what that literature does for us. Again, in a case like Human Origins, basically all the ancient text tells that's helpful on Human Origins is that people did tend to think in archetypal terms. That doesn't mean Israel would have to, but it certainly means it's no surprise that they do. That's a fairly typical way to think about Human Origins in the ancient world. Yes?
I wanted to say one of the first useful and discussions with one of you. I think I'm going to have to read your book on chapter 2 to really understand what you're talking about. So my question is, when is it coming out?
I'm up to chapter 6. There are 24 chapters. but actually, I mean, for the last 7 months, I live and breathe and eat and drink this stuff 24-7. I mean, I've been on the road for 7 months, giving this lecture 60 plus, almost 70 times. So I know what I think by now. I just have to write it. Well, there is a book coming out called The Four Views of Historical Adam. It's coming out in a month or two. And I have one of the views, it's the archetypal view, and you can get my material there in print. And that will be at least a step before your book comes out. Book I'm expecting end of 2014 or beginning of 2015.
Oh, goodness,
yes.
With the field of Old Testament studies, how much consensus is there among scholars about this Genesis interpretation? Where does your view fit? And where can I find those weapons that you use?
No, this is really right at the, Rick can't even call it the cutting edge, it's the bleeding edge. I mean, this is just new stuff, new ideas developing. And again, I've been talking about it all around the world, and other people have found it helpful. I've been getting very warm reception, as opposed to heated reception. but people are just absorbing it and thinking about it. They're not writing about it. So this is not really stuff you find other people writing about. But again, I can only speak anecdotally. I don't take votes. But you know, people are interested. They're intrigued. They're thinking about it. But in terms of evangelical scholarship, again, I find a lot of welcome for these thoughts. Not in my lecture tour, I was in some 14 countries, but I was also in 20 schools around this country, as well as a dozen churches, and I find my fellow academics show a lot of interest in
that. I wasn't speaking primarily of just evangelical, I meant just like scholarship in general, including secular scholars.
Well, of course, secular scholars don't care if you make sense of Genesis. They think it's mythological, so they're frankly aren't interested in the conversation. And look what I say about the ancient Near East, they would agree with. Okay? But again, this one's not as much based on ideas from ancient Near East, not as much as the Genesis one. Yes.
As I'm understanding it, you're saying you're rediscovering a interpretation that was lost and recovered. Are you finding some older literature that would be more compatible with your thinking than modern literature?
Sure. Our earliest interpretations of Genesis are in the intertestamental period. Again, it's all written about the mystic event. what I'm talking about, Ben Sirach, is intertestamental literature. And there we've got a whole chapter about the creation of humanity, and it's all functional and archetypal. It doesn't say it the same way I say it, but it's that kind of viewpoint. You get to some of the earliest church fathers, and you'll see some of this information, again, just kind of bits and pieces. I don't expect to find a lot of it, because, again, by the time we have our earliest translations, we are already in Hellenism, and that makes a difference. Yes, sir.
Could you please comment on the archetypal function of mortality in relation to the biblical concept of sin?
Again, the archetypal idea of mortality is just saying that we are all mortal. Created from dust, that's all of us are created from dust, not just that first guy. All of us are created from dust, therefore that is an archetypal element. We all die, that's archetypal. Okay, sin enters through the historical act of that individual, not then as an archetype, but as a priestly representative. And so in that sense, sin comes to all of us, representative, through whom it came. Remember, this happens in the Old Testament as well. The priests have a certain responsibility, and what they do can affect everybody. That's not archetypal, that's priestly representation. Did I answer your question? I'm not sure if I did.
Because the concept of sin, what we traditionally believe, we take chapter 3 as the disobedience. And this is what we are looking in chapter 2.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's correct. Chapter 3, as I mentioned, I believe the fall is trying to be like God. And what that does is it brings sin into the world. I think that the model that has sin impact the whole environment, all creation groans. And then we all catch it from the environment. I think that has some sense to it. But again, it's tough to work out how original sin is transmitted and all of these things. Why Christ doesn't catch it, how we each get it. That, I'm not dealing with those issues. Those are difficult issues. I see some things that I think give some decent answers, but that's not really my area. But that idea, I mean, just like when somebody dumps pollution into the air, we all suffer for it. You know, because they brought that pollution into the world. Okay? I don't know how much longer we are supposed to go with questions here. Is that all right?
So you wear out.
But I know there's still some hands up, and I'm going to try to address them.
I'll maybe wrap it up.
Okay. Let's take maybe two or three more. I see one, two, and three. Okay? So let's go with those three, and then we'll...
How do you think about death before the fall?
Again, if you were created mortal, there was death before the fall.
In relation to Romans 5, where it says sin or death.
Again, Romans 5 is telling how we in a post-fall world are subject to death. We're subject to death because of sin. Sin took away the antidote, and therefore we die. Okay? And that doesn't say anything about mortality or immortality. Yes, sir.
Your view is far less adversarial to a Darwinian view than some other evangelical views I'm familiar with. If I can perhaps be a little impertinent, I'd like to ask, to what degree, if any, was, in your experience, the evolution of your thinking, did you at any point have some kind of sense of an awareness of the scientific explanation for origins, compare them with what you had been taught about Genesis interpretations, and was that part of your motivation to rethink Genesis, or
motivation. I certainly have always been aware of the science. This is my wife, by the way. She's a trained biochemistry. I can't help but be aware of the science. I live in that kind of context. Okay, so certainly I'm aware of it. But I am not a science person. Okay? And therefore, I don't really have high hopes of making sense of the science for me and sorting all of that out. I am not motivated by the science. I still understand that sometimes science may progress to such a point that it would motivate us to think again about the biblical text. I don't object to that, but that's not really the course of action that might follow. I just think it's my profession, it's my life, it's my passion to understand the biblical text better. And if that makes science fit better, that's great. If it makes science fit worse, oh well, I'm a Bible guy. So, yeah, it didn't really go that way. Okay. And one more one's over here. Yes, sir.
You mentioned it was physical death. What was the antidote for the tree of life?
The tree of life is the antidote for physical death.
If there was physical death, how would that help?
Because that gave them life. Life comes being in the presence of God. And this brought to that presence, brought to that life, and the tree was doing that. How a tree would do it, that's up to God to do that. Again, if there was a physical tree, God made that work. I don't know how. If there wasn't, and it just symbolized life in the presence of God, that's fine too. I could live with it. But we don't have to make that decision. Okay, we better call quits on this. I'll hang around and be happy to talk to you more.
There are refreshments upstairs.